George Pinkerton, Reel 6. So,
when we went to Wismar,
right,
which was as far as we got, and then of course the Russians proceeded to come into that part of Germany, so we had to withdrew to we were in Magdeburg for a time, and then the Russians came in there, and we had to withdrew to Brunswick.
Right. What was the reputation of the Russian troops?
Oh, they were scared to death of them. You know, the
who was scared to get
the Germans were, right. Yes. I don't say that, I mean, I'm sure as far as soldiers go, they weren't, but the German population were, there was quite an industry in, among some of the troops for smuggling German girls over the border. But, because they were you know, the Germans, the Russians had this tremendous record of rape and pillage and so on, and frightened the life out of everybody.
Right. So, what sort of time were the German civilians having in Germany?
Very, very rough. I mean, they got very little to eat, and a lot of them were living sort of in makeshift shelters and so on. But the really trying thing was the... impressed me most was the hundreds and hundreds of displaced persons who had been slave workers, and who half of them didn't know where they came from. Half of them, well, they knew what language they spoke, but nobody else did. And there were thousands and thousands of them. Mm. And it was absolutely horrifying.
Mm. Where did you see them?
Oh, everywhere, you know. I mean, they'd got sort of camps of some sort, particularly around Brunswick. They'd got some sort of camps, basically called Wolfenbüttel. And they'd got, you know, vague sort of hutting places, but there's no proper food or anything at all. Mm. I was lucky. I didn't find Belsen, but... I knew quite a few people who've been on that particular day.
Mm. Well, had you heard about them? Well, when did you first hear, I should say?
Well, after it had been pound, while we were there. Mm. Which, well, perhaps changed one's views of the Germans in a way, although one realised that the ordinary German had nothing to do with it. Mm. But all these poor, wretched DPs and Poles and so on. Mm. Yeah.
So, on to Brunswick. And where were you based at Brunswick?
In Brunswick.
In Brunswick. We were billeted.
We were billeted in a rather nice place outside. It had been a training camp for Volkswagen engineers, I believe. Mm. And it was very nice, actually. We had a nice little house there. And it was outside a bit, and the actual headquarters in Brunswick was the Luftwaffe headquarters, which was very nice, so we were very comfortable in there.
Yeah.
And by which time I was sort of doing virtually no medical work at all. What we then started doing was medical examinations on people for discharge, because, of course, some people had been... got very early numbers, demob numbers, and started coming out as soon as the war ended.
Right, so you started doing that medical for discharge?
Yes, yes.
End of 45 or...?
Yes, it would be, yes. Yes,
yes. Right, okay.
Or, yes.
So how detailed was that medical?
Oh, just a routine medical examination, eyes, hearing, so on, see they can stand up straight.
Yeah.
I remember one chap who came in for me, and I said, can you read the number on that door? I said, look at the door. Can you read those letters on the door? And he nearly said, what door? But he did say, what letters? And he couldn't see a thing. And I said, what have you been doing? So he said, well, I've been driving. I said, where have you been driving? He said, everywhere. He'd driven in Norway, France, he hadn't driven. I mean, he'd driven all over the Middle East and so on, but he couldn't see his door.
Presumably he'd followed the vehicle in.
Well, presumably followed the vehicle. It makes one wonder whether these things about tests for driving are justifiable. But that was a rather far away. Yes, I was doing those for quite a few time, and one or two of the other medical officers who'd been in longer than I had got discharged, I went and did the odd RMO job, here and there. And for about a week, I was the deputy DADMS, Deputy Assistant Director of Medical Services, while the proper DADMS was on holiday.
Right. What did being DADMS involve?
Sitting in an office and making a nuisance of yourself.
Oh, right. Notionally in charge of what all medical services.
Well, the ADMS, you see, is the top. This ADMS, the Assistant Director of Medical Services. And he is the top of the division, and the DADMS is his understudy.
Uh-huh.
But I've been doing that for about a week.
Right. Did you have any thoughts about staying in the army?
No, not really. No. They tried to persuade us, actually. We were offered. And, of course, the other thing was that, by and large, the division was still being... when we started off there, the war in Japan was still going on. And the division was really sort of keying itself up and setting itself up to go out to the east. It wasn't until anybody dropped an atom bomb on them that it stopped. There's one reason I've always been rather thankful for the atom bomb. Because, I'd seen two countries pack up the war without coming to any harm, and I thought, well, perhaps we might be one too lucky to take three.
Yes. Yeah. So what was the regret feeling? I mean, you were seeing a lot of people who were due to be discharged, of people desperate to get home.
Well, people...
It was over now.
Yeah.
Was there any reason why they wouldn't get discharged medically, or was it just...
It was just all so that they couldn't claim after the war that they'd hit something other when they were thrown out of the army.
Mm.
It was just sort of medical insurance, really, I think.
Right. I mean, a lot of people later on got pensions for deafness and so on.
Oh, yes. Well,
as you were involved with the medical assessments as
they
left the army, what did you feel about that?
Well, I mean... one could only describe what you found and report that on their chart. But anybody was a bit different, they would go on and get consulted opinions later.
Mm. Mm. Did you see many men at exit from service who were traumatised and were clearly going to have some sort of problems readjusting?
Not so many. I think that one didn't see, most of the, as I say, most of the chaps we were dealing with had been sort of inactive. I think there were more problems like that with POWs.
Mm.
We had really no contact, although we did see these remarkable collection of rather scruffy looking individuals arriving from nowhere saying hi,
And they were released POWs.
And they were released POWs. And, of course, the Japanese POWs were very much the other way. I mean, they were terribly traumatised.
Mm. You saw some of the European POWs.
Yes, we did. We met them sort of on our way up Germany. They were coming down the other way.
Right.
But they seemed to be, was just passing them, say hi, sort of thing.
Mm. Did you have any contact with any ex... Japanese POWs?
Only as patients after the war.
Right, okay, yes. And did you get some sort of estimation of the trauma they were carrying with them? Because they didn't get sort of debriefed, did they, or cancelled or whatever, as they left the army after
no,
prisoners,
no, totally, did they? No, no, no. Mm. No. Worst time, it wasn't much the trauma of it. He got a very severe vitamin deficiency.
Mm.
And of course, my sister-in-law, my sister-in-law's husband's sister,
mm-hmm.
Married a chap who'd been a POW, and he was old to the end of his days.
Mm.
He was, you know, very dark, very withdrawn and so on. Nice man, but...
Right. So, in Brunswick then, until you left, how did your... how did you get notice of the fact that you were going to be...
Well, you see, one has had a DMOB number, which starting at the top and worked down. The blokes who'd been with the division virtually ever since it started, you would say, "Well, yours is a telephone number," but it wasn't. They because there was a shortage of doctors, and so they we got out really rather ahead of our number. Those of us who couldn't persuade to stay on.
Yes, yeah. What I mean, did you have a particular ambition to go and do something else in medicine? Is that why you didn't want to stay in the army?
No, I'd had enough soldiering, really.
Right.
Although looking back on it, I'm not certain. I don't think I could stay there.
Right. So you travelled from Brunswick to be demobbed in Britain, did you?
That's right.
Yes, where did you go?
We came from Cuxhaven to Goole, I think. Mm-hmm. And then we got on a train. Where did I actually get demobbed? I think in somewhere like Leeds.
Mm-hmm.
Although we're still in uniform and so on, we were measured for our DMOB suits and so on, and then got on a train and came down, and it was really rather strange because the train was late and I was hoping to go on and get, because my wife was living with her parents in near Luton at the time, and we're hoping to get home there, but I was late, and there used to be a little between King's Cross station and Euston Station, there used to be a little triangle of land, and there was a show house on this thing, which was used as a little officers' transit camp for people who want to spend the night there. So I spent the night on this in this funny little old house in the middle of between King's Cross and Euston Station, and then I went home. And of course, we had a. I was actually demobbed, I think it was probably in Leeds, somewhere like that. But when I was actually demobbed when I got home, and then of course I had to officially stayed in the army for another couple of months, and it was, I think, about July that I eventually found myself a real civilian.
Right. And what did you go on to do then?
I wanted to get some civilian medicine done then.
Mm.
And so I looked around for a job, and I went as a medical officer, what do we call him? Resident medical officer at the Royal Masonic Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't a Mason, but
yeah.
I enjoyed that. It was a super, very, very interesting job, actually.
Mm.
Because the Royal Masonic at that time, I think it's shut now, had all the top consultants in London had patients in the Royal Masonic. So anybody who wanted to get to know their way around the top brass of the medical profession and was there had a very good opportunity to meet them. And very interesting that. And then I eventually went on after that. I went to Hammersmith and did a job at Hammersmith Hospital. And then I thought, well, I must get some work to, you know, some proper paid work. So I took an assistantship in a hospital, in a practice in Hammersmith, which I stayed until we moved to Dunstable.
Right, right. And you remained a GP then?
I remained a GP.
Yes, right, okay. So I don't think you've actually told me everything, because you've got the military medal, haven't you?
Cross.
Military cross, sorry, yes. So where did you get that?
Well, somewhere in Italy or Sicily, I don't know. Pat had the citation, which I don't know where it's gone to at last. I've never seen it. I've seen it once when she got it, but I've not ever seen it since. So,
right.
So it's disappeared somewhere.
Right.
I'm sure there must be somewhere
I can
get it on the internet.
Right. I'm sure you can. I expect the Imperial War Museum site might be able to.
Yeah, they might well be.
Yeah. So, do you know what you... Was it one particular incident that was...
I think if you survived and were in the right sort of place, you've probably got something like that. I think some of these, I mean, the MCs, VCs rather, I think a lot of this was simply due to rage. You know, people went absolutely blind with rage and did the most ridiculous things. And I know one chap who got a DSO, which of course is one down from the VC. They said that he'd got completely lost. This was somewhere in the desert, and wandered around and did the most absurd things because he hadn't got a clue where he was going. But I think that's probably a libel.
You mentioned someone called McCausland.
Rags. Yes, McCausland Rags.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a fascinating chap, Rags was.
Yes. How do you spell his name?
I think he was McCausland, M-C... Corsland, C-O-R-C-E-L-A-N-D,
oh, right.
Hyphen, Riggs, R-A-G-G-S.
Right. Okay.
Now, Rags, we all know as Rags, he was a delightful man. Mm. Rags had been, I don't know why, being Irish, and he had a farm in Ireland, but he had been with the 1st Battalion, the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, mm-hmm. as a subaltern, in 1914, and he was the youngest subaltern to go to France with the 1st Battalion KYLI in World War I. He then survived battle for some years in France and joined the RFC, and he had the only person that interested him, I know, who used to wear RFC wings, and he joined the RFC, and when the war ended, I think he'd won an MC somewhere along the line. He stayed in the RAF, and he went until about I suppose the early 30s, and then he retired and went back to his farm. And, blow me down, he then, when this war was coming along, he then became the oldest subaltern to go to France in World War II with the battalion. And he became a company commander and then second in commander and then commanded the battalion. But he was a nice man, Rags. Mm. He was a real gent. And a real war.
He must have seemed terribly old to you.
Well, somehow he didn't. You know, he'd been an Irishman, like so many Irishmen. He was ageless. Delightful chap, Rags was.
Yeah.
There was a history there.
So, did he talk to you at all about the First War?
Not a lot. No, he used to talk about flying and things like that. Mm. He was... interesting, Rags.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, did you ever carry a weapon?
I always used to carry one, but I was supposed to carry one.
Right.
But I did draw it one night, but when I was in the... I didn't have it on me, but I had a weapon and the thing. I woke in the middle of the night in somewhere outside, in a tent outside Damascus, finding a nasty-looking native cutting the wall away with the knife. And so I yelled at him, and he ran, and I took the revolver out and let a couple of shots go. But that was the only thing I ever fired, I think.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I used to do some time. I swapped something for an American automatic, which I used to have to play with in the garden.
So, I mean, there was an awful lot of barter and
yes,
and negotiation.
Yeah, one of the
so on in Germany at the end of the war.
One of the things you could always get anything from the Americans was, I think, again, what's happened to mine? A leather jerkin. They love those. And they still are a jolly good garment. I've still got one. Mine was issued to me in the mountains of Italy in 1943, I think.
So you must have seen a lot of the black market in Germany. I mean,
not a lot, really. No.
It's quite difficult, that, because it was so... Yeah. For cigarettes, you could buy almost anything.
Yes,
you know, that sort of thing. It has a nasty taste.
Yes, we had with the RASC at that time, of course, and one of our... I'm not still with the field ambulance, are I, a lot of this time?
This is in, sorry, which town are we in? Brunswick? Lubeck? Sorry, which town are you talking about now? Brunswick or RASC?
RASC, that's right. Yes, that's right. That's who I was with then.
Yeah.
Yes, I left for Peel Emerson to the RASC, which was a super job, because one had, you had people all over the division. That you could always find an excuse to go and visit them, you know. It was even I used to borrow an aeroplane to fly down not fly myself, of course, borrow an aeroplane, fly down to the unit sometimes. Uh-huh. We had an Army Air Force unit finish up more than I had to do, and they used to add extra staff cars.
So that sounds quite a leisured, if I may say.
Oh, it was.
Unpressured.
Yes, a very unpressured job. It was a very nice job. I enjoyed it. They were very nice people, too.
Are there any particular sort of the troops you dealt with that stand out in your mind? There must have been lots of little stories. Do you know what I mean? That you saw glimpses of people's progress, you know, for better or worse.
Well, I didn't really see many outside your own unit, though.
Right. I suppose your contact with them was more fleeting.
Yes, it was.
They had contact with you, they're on their way somewhere.
You used to watch these Army Air Corps people spotting on the Garigliano, you know, jolly dangerous job. They'd fly up and down with these things and spot where their guns were landing. But the Germans didn't very often take a pot at them, because if anybody took a pot at them, they would bring the entire 600 guns down on it, and so that they left them rather alone. But you used to see a puff of smoke in the air, and they were singing, and waiting a few minutes later, there'd be a tremendous thunder of guns.
So, I mean, did you have much contact or any contact with American troops?
Yes, we did. Not a lot. We were somewhere, I think, in Italy. Before we left Italy, we handed over to an American division. I can't remember who it was, but the thing that surprised us was how keen they were to learn.
Really?
One didn't think the Americans would be keen to learn, but they were. They were absolutely dead keen to learn. And they picked our brains for all they were worth.
What sort of reputation did they have generally then?
Oh, very good. Very good. Yeah.
And was there animosity? I mean, No.
I mean, they did, but I don't think it really caused any animosity.
Right. And what about Canadians?
I didn't see much of Canadians. I bet I didn't see anything of Canadians, really, did we? No, we didn't. They were in Sicily, but they were down the other end of the field.
Were there, any other nations' troops that you came across?
It's very odd. Well, of course, Indian divisions.
Oh, yes.
Who are very good troops, of course.
Where did you come across them?
There was an Indian division in Italy, which I bumped into occasionally, and we had an Indian field surgical unit with us in Persia.
Did you?
And which was quite amusing because occasionally we used to draw Indian rations and take them next door to the Indian field surgical unit, and who would brew us up a very good curry. The other thing I don't remember about them, they had an Australian surgeon, a chap called Stonham, who was a delightful bloke, but the most unmilitary-looking chap you have ever seen in your life. He really did. Oh, Stonham, he was, you know, everything all undone and so on, the cigarette hanging out of the corner of his mouth. He was a very good surgeon, actually. But anyway, when we moved out from Perthshire, I said goodbye to poor old Stonham. I thought, I'll never see poor old Stonham again. And some months later, I was walking through the streets of Damascus, and who was standing on a corner, a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, was so solemn. So we had a drink, and then I said, well, goodbye, old boy. And he says, I'll never see you again. And he said, no. And some weeks after the war finished, I was walking through the street of Hammersmith, and standing on a corner on with a cigarette hair out of his mouth was old Stalin. he was a very good surgeon, but most unmilitary man I have ever seen.
He sounds like something out of Evelyn Waugh,
doesn't
he?
Oh, he was, yes, yes.
Sort of kept turning up.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Indian surgical...
Indian Peel Surgical Unit, yes.
Right, so what, tell me about them.
Well, they were all Indian troops, except the commander. I don't think Stonham was commander, he might have been. But they had a surgeon and a surgical nurses and so on. They were very good.
Mm.
And
why were they so far over to the east, or the west, rather?
Well, trying to think where... There were one or two rather odd Indian troops who cropped up. There was a remarkable unit called Skinner's Horse, which cropped up somewhere. I can't remember where. But there were some very very strange Indian units. But the Indian Medical Service, of course, was very good. Mm. They tried quite hard to recruit people who were leaving the army for the Indian Medical Service.
Right.
I might have been quite tempted for that if it hadn't been for coming to go and live in India.
Yeah. What was your opinion of the Germans as soldiers?
Very good. Mm. Very good. Mm. Yes, we always had... I think the Germans and ours, we all had great respect for each other.
Mm. Mm. I mean, the Gestapo had a different reputation.
Yes.
Was that something you were aware of at the time?
Not really. I don't think one didn't really know about these things much until someone walked into Belsen. And then the whole penny dropped in a big way.
Right. Mm. So attitudes changed, really, at that point.
Yes.
Right. OK.